sources of inspiration, and in reading about Roger Williams, I hope to answer the question, how did a man born in 1603 become such a radical trailblazer? I want to start the incredible story of Roger Williams by putting him in historical context. It's the early 1600s. Okay, there's extreme and violent conflict that is religious in nature. It's between Catholics and Protestants in both Europe and England. It was over 100 years since Luther nailed his famous 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church. The 30 Years' War was raging on the continent, and it was actually a series of bloody wars over religion. It was 20 years before the English Civil War exploded between Protestants, which were largely Puritans on one side, and King Charles, and those who favored a more Catholic, like Church of England, on the other. And it was just the time when English traders, adventurers, and Puritans seeking a safe haven began a trickle of emigration to the New World. And this trickle became a flood once the Puritans of Plymouth Plantation, who came earliest on the Mayflower in 1620, and then later the settlements of Salem, Boston, Roxbury, Dorchester, New Haven, and others of the 1620s and 30s, showed that they could survive the shock of disease and New England winters. Now, William's entire life was lived at the center of first this English power struggle, and then an American Puritan power struggle. And the religious and political dimensions really overlapped. Religiously, it was the Anglican Church, as it was, still influenced by Catholicism, versus those Protestants who would purify it, the Puritans. Politically, it was the monarchy versus Parliament. The monarchy, King James and then King Charles, wished to preserve the church as it was. It was King James who introduced the notion of the divine right of kings into English law and commissioned a new biblical translation, the King James Bible, which, by the way, increased the emphasis on obedience to authority. On the other hand, Parliament represented the people, or at least some of the people, a group which widened over time. Parliament was largely Protestant and Puritan, and it drew its authority from the English common law. So against this backdrop in England, Roger Williams made his first big networking move as a boy of 13. In around 1616, he met the man who was to become his biggest influence, Sir Edward Coke, one of the greatest lawyers and judges in British history. Cook noticed that Williams had an invaluable skill that lawyers needed. Can you imagine what that might be? It was shorthand. Cook needed someone to take detailed legal notes, and this began an extremely close, almost father and son, lifelong relationship. And imagine this young Roger Williams at 13 being everywhere where his mentor was and taking everything down in notes. Now, you know the saying, and it's not gender neutral, that a man's home is his castle? It was Cook who said, quote, "An Englishman's house is as his castle, and each man's home his safest refuge." Now, the importance of this statement is it carved out a space of privacy and individual rights that the state could not touch for each freeman, each Englishman, and that covered the Englishman's family. Each Englishman, in other words, had a castle just like the monarch, and that was meant to be a safe refuge from authoritarian power. Cook spent his life challenging the crown and championing individuals' rights against arbitrary state and royal power. He had many great and powerful clients, but as John Barry writes, his greatest and most important client was the very law itself, the common law of England. In learning about Williams and his times, I just realized we owe so much to English common law. The term refers to ancient traditions of rights that were made common or consistent throughout England as early as the 1200s under Henry III. This is how crimes such as murder became violations of the state, not just of individuals. Earlier, even murder could often be resolved privately by the perpetrator paying money to the victim's family, for example. And besides common law, rights and liberties were based, of course, on the Magna Carta, full name being the Magna Carta Libertatum, the Great Charter of Liberties. This was forced upon King John in 1215 by a group of feudal barons to limit the king's power and guarantee their rights in law. Even this drew on ancient traditions and charters stating things like, "No free man shall be taken or imprisoned or exiled, but by the lawful judge of his peers or by the law of the land." Now, of course, the circle of those who have rights has been continuously enlarged through struggle, expanding to all male property owners, then all freemen, then all men, and shockingly, even women, and even some rights for children. So this was the whole English heritage of rights on which Roger Williams and his mentor Cook drew, sometimes at the risk of their lives, more than once. Cook had many clashes with King James, and young Roger Williams was present at every moment of this historic struggle. He was there the very next day when Cook blocked special religious court charges against a layman, saying, quote, "The ecclesiastical judge cannot examine any man upon the intention and thought in his heart, for it hath been said in the proverb, thought is free." Now, Williams had a second great mentor whose influence you can also see running like a ribbon throughout the rest of his life, and this was Sir Francis Bacon. We know him as a brilliant intellectual and a pioneer of the scientific method. The same year that the Mayflower carried desperate Puritans to America in 1620, Bacon published his amazing work, Novum Organum, True Directions into the Interpretation of Nature. In it, he rejected both Aristotle's and the Scholastics' approach to truth, which was to follow logic and kind of ignore evidence, just keep in your brain. And he also rejected the other extreme, empiricism, the idea that all knowledge comes from sensory experience without any theory. Instead, he advocated the careful experimentation and observation to develop theory, the modern scientific method, essentially, that we have used ever since. Williams read this work and was deeply influenced by the idea that you have to approach the world neither blinded by your own assumptions nor without guiding beliefs. He held firm to his Puritan religious beliefs. Those were his guiding beliefs. But Bacon's scientific method of openness and experimentation without prejudgment seemed to influence Williams in many ways, including how he interacted with Native Americans. More on that shortly. So imagine for a moment that you had two brilliant mentors, that you were a charming, brilliant, promising young minister, a Puritan reformer. Like Cook, with whom you worked day in and day out, you would have learned deep courage and intellectual integrity, even risking death. You would have seen in the entwined religious-political cataclysm the dangers of mixing church and state. And as a Puritan, your starting point, your theory, was God's commandments as stated in the Bible. But after that, following Sir Francis Bacon, you would be open to new experiences as evidence about the world. So Williams graduated from Cambridge University, became a passionate Puritan and a minister, then still in the Church of England, but he was a controversial dissenter. The ever-increasing pressure and persecution of Puritans led to his fleeing England on the ship the Lion in 1631. Now, as you heard in the reading, it was just 1 year before, in 1630, when almost 1,000 Puritan men and women sailed to Massachusetts, because even though they still considered themselves loyal members of the Church of England, they had wanted to reform it, which was taboo to both king and church. And when they arrived, John Winthrop was their governor of the Boston settlement. It was when the ship the Lion was unloading in 1631, not when the Mayflower landed in 1620, that the governor declared what became the first Thanksgiving. Now, you heard also in the reading that despite his great reputation as a clergyman, Williams got off to a bad start right away by turning down a position that it was called theologian with the Boston Church. After meeting with church leaders and finding what he thought were remnants of the corrupt Church of England in their practices. But soon his critiques grew more radical. The Massachusetts Bay Colony was in practice a theocracy, and Williams argued that magistrates had no power to enforce the first four commandments, which were only between an individual and God: to have no God before him, to make no graven image, nor take the Lord's name in vain, and keep the Sabbath holy. So he was starting to lay the groundwork in America for separation of church and state, which was quite risky for Williams, both in the Bay Colony and England. Not only that, but Williams was highly controversial in his treatment of the indigenous people of America. Consider this, and it's ironic, because converting Indians was the main justification for these Puritans like Winthrop and others for getting royal charters to establish settlements in America. Puritans sincerely wanted to convert Indians for their good and salvation, so perceived, to sanctify the world which would usher in Christ's return, and also, more pragmatically, prevent the spread of Catholicism by French and Spanish colonial rivals. But the Puritan settlements, in fact, made very little effort to convert Indians. However, Williams did so. Now, he traveled and traded among several tribes. He used a canoe for 50 years, which may have strengthened him and helped him live to the age of 80. He entertained Indians in his home, both to evangelize, but also out of the curiosity that Bacon displayed as a scientist. Most importantly, he wanted not to convert by force. He believed no one could become a true Christian without fully understanding what it meant. So, therefore, he had to learn these people's languages. And he was virtually the only settler then to do so. His experience led him to claim, quote, "Nature knows no difference between Europe and Americans, that is, Native Americans, in blood, birth, bodies, etc." His sincere belief in their essential equality, not just lip service, was highly unusual. He really was an early anthropologist, and he wrote, quote, "The sociableness of the nature of man appears in the wildest of them, who love society, families, cohabitation, and consociation of houses and towns together. The wildest of the sons of men have found a necessity to cast themselves into some mold or form of government." What made Indians different was their lack of European knowledge and technology. And he learned a lot from them, though. For example, the use of controlled burns to clear underbrush and let new trees grow, he learned from Native Americans. But Williams' most radical belief about Native Americans challenged the whole rationale for Europeans taking American land. That rationale was that the land was unoccupied and unused. Indians were just savages roaming randomly. Well, Williams was grounded in English common law, which linked rights to property. He observed the Indians used the land and concluded that therefore they owned the land. He wrote, "The natives are very exact and punctual in the bounds of their lands, belonging to this or that prince or people. And I have known them to make bargain and sale amongst themselves for a small piece or quantity of ground." Well, the implication, of course, was that by rights, no English king could grant what he did not own unless he purchased it from its rightful owners. That was radical in 1630, and it's radical today. So Williams took these concerns privately to other Puritan leaders, and as you can imagine, they were explosive. But what really, really endangered him was his claim that, quote, "No church or person can have power over another church." Sound familiar? Congregational polity threatened the central authority of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which relied on total obedience to state authority. Williams just would not stop. He challenged the Bay Colony's religious compulsory loyalty oath because he thought it produced hypocrisy, since non-believers who made this oath profaned God. He attacked anything imposed on individuals without their consent. And most profoundly for the heritage of our country, he echoed his mentor, Sir Edward Cook, by claiming, quote, "No man may be punished for his thoughts, expanded to include the freedom to speak one's thoughts." Well, that did it. That was when he was banished from all Puritan colonies in the middle of an especially brutal New England winter. Probably felt about like this morning, and maybe a lot worse. He was close to the Wampanoag tribe, which sheltered him, and especially he was close to the Narragansetts and their chiefs. They gave Williams permission to settle within certain boundaries of what is now Rhode Island. He became a farmer. Followers joined him. The colony was slowly established. And regardless of Williams' extreme personal religiosity, which infused every aspect of a Puritan's life, the Providence Government Compact excised all mention of God. This was unique among all European founding documents. Well, John Winthrop in Massachusetts Bay Colony held that the government's power to rule came from God and was accountable only to God. But the human beings in power, of course, interpreted whatever they wanted. Williams, in contrast, was developing the idea that governments, quote, received their authority from and were responsible to their citizens. He and the Rhode Island founders wrote into their legal compact that no community member be accounted a delinquent for or because of doctrine. That is, they established freedom of religion. This was because Williams thought any enforcement of God's law relied on human interpretation of it. And since humans were imperfect, inevitably they would make errors in discerning God's law. In his view and that of our constitutional framers about 160 years later, Congress, or any government body, shall make no law that would establish a state religion. So as the decades after 1630 passed, the New England settlements formed an alliance called the United Colonies, Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth, Connecticut, and New Haven. All of them continually attempted land grabs of Rhode Island, which they called, quote, a sewer that would allow any scum to live there. It was a good excuse because they really wanted the land. So the only way Williams could ensure the survival of Rhode Island was to do like the other leaders did and get a royal charter from England. So in 1644, Williams went back to England to lobby and secure it. Now, pursuing that goal, in 1644, Williams laid out his beliefs in a pamphlet, and he argued that church and state should be separated for the sake of the church. Like his mentor Francis Bacon, he looked at the evidence and concluded that every time the wall between church and state was broken, the church had been corrupted by the state. Williams basically said, if you mix religion and politics, you get politics. Well, somehow, his pamphlet, his personal charm, luck. Somehow it worked. And when he got his charter in 1644, it permitted the Rhode Island colony to be governed by majority rule. William's vision was democracy and freedom. And Rhode Island was then the freest society in the Western world. Williams then wrote a 400-page book, you'll be grateful that I'm not going to outline it in detail, outlining his arguments for separation of church and state and total freedom of religion. He had to write it anonymously, though, and his printer had to flee England with him back to the colonies. His use of observation and evidence, scientific method, shows the influence of Francis Bacon, and his vision of liberty shows the influence of Cook. But his argument was his own. Interestingly, for a free-thinking rebel, Williams was able to maintain relationships with powerful Puritan and Protestant leaders back in England, the English ones. Once Rhode Island had become a viable, well-populated settlement on land Williams legitimately purchased from Indians, he was usually able to get the support he needed, though often with enormous effort, public relations, and strategy. Now, it may have been that English leaders wanted a counterbalance to the power of the Bay, or the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and that benefited him. Amazingly, Williams's Rhode Island was an experiment in free thought unique in the world well over a century before the American Revolution and a century and a half before the French Revolution. In these political times, we will be challenged greatly by far greater powers than the Massachusetts Bay Colony. For example, private corporations as we know them today obviously then did not exist. The challenges of ethnic and cultural diversity today would have been unimaginable to Williams. We live in a time when one of the pillars of democracy, a free and responsible press, struggles to exist, replaced for many by social media where separate silos of different ideologies never meet in an open contest of ideas. Many readers, as we know, believe all manner of lies and alternative truths. Our democracy has never been challenged quite like this. Yet, as we face the conflicts ahead, it may be helpful to look back to Roger Williams. In a time of lies, we look back to him for his openness to the truths he discovered through clear-eyed observation. In a time of corruption, and there's always some corruption, we look back to Williams for his integrity. In a time when the alt-right social media, known for its white male supremacist aims, is represented in the president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, we look to Williams for his egalitarian vision. In the months and years to come, we look back to him for his courage. We will need them to pursue our vision of a world that protects the vulnerable, a world of equality, freedom, and justice. May it be so.